Today we're gonna talk about the next step in modularizing software. What I want to talk about today is multiple inheritance. So what does that comprise? We will talk about a few different things. First of all, a little bit on what inheritance means and what the different notions of inheritance can be. We'll talk about basic principles of inheritance. Then we're gonna have a look at a practical programming language that implements inheritance in its multiple inheritance flavor. And we will, this will be C++. In this respect, we will look at what the language offers and how it is translated to the LLVM intermediate code. We will have a look at the common things that we've seen already for languages like Java, once again from a C++ point of view. And then we're gonna extend it a little bit to also be able to inherit from several parents. And we will talk about the different implications that a change like this in the concepts makes to the implementation. And afterwards, we're gonna discuss a little bit what we've seen so far. Also, I will present to you something that is not present in the C++ approach, which is linearization. That is an approach that other languages that offer multiple inheritance actually go. And yeah, we'll talk about the basic principle that that is, or the basic problem that is solved via linearization and the different approaches that the languages that are out there have taken for solving ambiguities. Okay, so first of all, the basic motto for this and probably also the next lecture will be, well, so far we have only inherited functionality from one parent. Wouldn't it be nice to do so for several parents? In principle, well, it's always good to be able to do more, so we're quite positive on that. But we're still not clear about the implications that things like these concepts have. So let's have a look at what comes with this idea. First of all, let's talk about the different notions that something like multiple inheritance has. And first of all, there's the notion that inheritance can be seen from a point of view of inheriting implementations of code, which means actual implementations of methods. And also, the other notion is that you might not inherit actual code, but rather signatures of methods that you still have to implement. This is the notion of interface inheritance. And those two are kind of contrary to each other in the sense that how they are actually used in practice. So, the way that probably most of us have come in contact with inheritance, at least at the beginning in the introduction to computer science or something, these courses always motivate that you need to inherit in order to kind of integrate methods into your programs, or being able to use methods by kind of integrating them in the scope of your concrete method or your class. So the classic motivation was something like code reusage. So that is, no, once again, it's not crossed out. It means to be
highlighted.
So code reusage is the first motivation. The idea is that the parent offers a set of interesting methods for you, and all you need to do is extend the module by the code that makes your implementation or your version of the module more special or suited for your special purpose. So that works by giving the programmer the chance to modify the pre-given module by replacing particular methods with more specialized ones. Yeah. So the parent acts as a kind of a library of behaviors that you want to integrate into your program. You can specialize it. That's that's implemented like this in a lot of languages. The other idea of inheritance is the one of interface inheritance. This is something that is more related to, or could be seen as kind of a behavioral contract that you're initiating with the other module, in the sense that as a programmer, you are meant to provide your module with a set of signatures and implementations of these signatures that match with the signatures that another module still needs to have fulfilled. So this can be seen as something that you have a kind of library that is modularizable in the sense that you can plug in different own implementations of objects, and all of them must offer a certain set of signatures or a certain interface, and this interface is meant to be used by the module in a certain way. So that is a kind of contract that you have to know about, and you fulfill it by implementing the methods of this interface. So that is a kind of a different approach to the whole thing. And when seen in the context of multiple inheritance, then multiple interface inheritance is something that you get in languages like Java or C sharp or something. And when seen in the context of multiple implementation inheritance, you get something like this in languages like C++ or Lisp, something like that. There's plenty more in both categories. So let's have a look at examples. How what can be examples for these approaches? First, let's talk about the interface inheritance. That is, in many cases, something like this. You have a kind of basic pre-given module, like in this case, the bulldozer. The bulldozer is a kind of doing certain things with its components in a certain way, and the components are connected to the bulldozer via aggregation. And what it has is it has a slot for a house, and also a slot for the undercarriage, for example. Both of them are interfaces and can be instantiated with certain user-provided modules. For example, you can construct a bulldozer which has tracks for movement in very heavy environments, or wheels when you want to travel quite quickly. Same, you can configure the bulldozer with different houses. For example, you might want to dig a deep hole. Then you need not this one. For the hole, you need the power shovel, which can dig out large holes. And if you want to move away certain heaps of things, you might want to configure it with a front loader. And each of these are concrete implementations of a pre-given interface for which we have kind of a contract how it will be used in my pre-given module, the bulldozer. So the bulldozer will use the house in cases where it want to start working or something. So that would be a typical example for interface inheritance. And there's also the idea of implementation inheritance from multiple parents. And yeah, you can think of, for example, a situation where you have base objects that offer functionality, like the class for a ship. A ship can, for example, blow its horn or move to somewhere else in the sea. Whereas a different class is a class of airports. An airport can give shelter to certain aircraft. And you can combine the functionality of those to something common, which would be, for example, the aircraft carrier, which can then make use of the ship's properties and methods. It can also toot or move to somewhere, and it can also give shelter to airplanes, and might also be able to carry out an airstrike somewhere, combining all the methods that it has inherited from its parents. So those are the different approaches to using inheritance or multiple inheritance to achieve modularity. Yeah. One thing that you has also often been taught to you in the beginnings of your career as object-oriented programmers is probably the Lisk of substitution principle, although I'm not sure whether you got to know it from with this certain name. But yeah, Lisk of is that lovely lady here who has thought a little bit about object orientation and come up with this basic principle that functions that are written with references to some certain classes in mind needs to be able to cope also with references to classes that are derived from the ones that they were originally planned to be used with. And it's meant to make absolutely no difference in the usage. So that was one of the basic things that you were growing up with, which actually something that might turn out to create a little bit more of problems that are a little bit unusual for your for a basic understanding, because well, in those introductory courses you learn that everything can be modeled with typical inheritance relations, and it's a good thing to do implementation inheritance in a way like this. And yeah, what are situations that might occur? One of the basic examples is quite often that you try to model shapes in introductory courses, and you might start with defining a shape mind with methods that yield the width and the height for certain shapes, and also the area and something like that. Well, for example, you could define a rectangle as having methods to set the different properties, for example, set the width and set the height, which would then assign numbers to the attributes and then return it in the getter method. So far, no problem. And then you might think of, for example, a square being a specialized version of the rectangle, in the sense that that should also offer a width and a set height method, but this time as it should still stay a square whatever you do, you would also modify the corresponding other attribute so that both of them stay the same. So when you do something like that, you have specialized your base class in some way. And yeah, imagine that you have also have another programmer that has devised a very clever algorithm with working on rectangles. What you wanted to do is then set the height and the length of the rectangle object, and would continue working by assuming that when he has set the height and the width of the rectangle, that multiplying them afterwards would give him the area that he has set into the whole thing, and would assume that you could also do the area code outside and just get 12, for example. And it turns out that when you use the more special version of Square, like this one, you would have ended up with a valid square afterwards, which would also act as a rectangle. But turns out that for the square, the assumption that the height and the width would be the values that you get from height and width afterwards are not the ones that you had before, because you have kind of connected the modification of the attributes afterwards. So your assumption that you had in your surrounding algorithm that you would work with an ordinary rectangle broke at that point. So with this inheritance, you must be very careful in the way how you interpret these inheritances. There's in principle, there's the idea that you should always think in the whole thing as specializing, and also in the sense of talking between talking about these objects as the child object as being of the same class as the base class, in the sense that Square should accord to is a rectangle in kind of relational talking. And this holds only so far in this case as the interfaces are concerned. As soon as you start to talk about the more kind of functional properties, the whole system might suffer a little bit. And for these kind of properties, you need to talk about kind of behavioral assumptions, and these are ones that are not covered in the inheritance that we talk about right now. There's ways to also be able to kind of inherit certain things like invariants or pre and post conditions for methods, but they're currently not covered in languages like C++ or Java right from the start. So if you are more interested in inheriting things like that, you should have a look at publications of Mrs. Liskov. She has done a little bit more in this area. Yes, please.
So does this example now predict the Liskov principle or not? The Liskov principle assuming behavior
This shows that you have to specify a little bit more on what you're talking to, because what she actually says is that it must be able to use the objects, which is a little bit fishy in this case, because it doesn't really specify whether it's all about the interfaces or also about the behavior of the whole thing. And I think in the beginning, when this principle was first devised, it was not so clear how this whole thing was meant. And turns out that with the means that we get from languages like these, where you only declare your inheritance relation based on the interfaces of your objects, then this being able to use objects cannot comprise these behavioral issues that are offered here. So strictly, when you interpret this being able to use objects with if you interpret them with signatures only, then everything went fine here, and this is not a situation that would be a problem of the language, but would be your fault because you were assuming more than was actually offered to you, because you implemented the interfaces right, and there's a relation between those classes, but actually it does not comprise the behavior, and you assumed too much. You kind of the black box principle that is in there, which means that something like reasoning about the internals of something like a rectangle is meant to be done by the rectangle itself, and you should not assume outside of your object anything. And yeah, in this case, that this is an assumption which is meant to be internal. So you cannot assume that the area is related somehow in the is related to the protocol in which you have used the interface. So that is something that's plainly not in the business of the not the responsibility of the system. Yeah, but clearly there is, if you interpret her must be able to use in a more semantic way than doing inheritance with interfaces only and with implementations only is clearly not enough. You also need to be able to inherit invariants, for example. And if you do so, then you get difficulties in relating the rectangle with a square anymore, because you actually you're not able to fulfill this invariant anymore, that setting the width and the height will lead to width and height being multiplied with each other and resulting in the area. Okay. So, yeah, that's just a kind of excursion to motivate that there's even more than just implementation and interface as objects to inherit. Let's just talk about the inheritance that is done in C++ right now. So for that, we would have a look at how this inheritance is actually implemented in a real C++ compiler. And for that, I've chosen one that was open to everyone already in the past. So that was a project that is called LLVM. The name has once been motivated by low-level virtual machine, so it was kind of something like the Java virtual, or meant to be something like the Java virtual machine was for Java. Meanwhile, they have dropped the interpretation of LLVM as low-level virtual machine, as the whole project grew a lot and it turned out to be a lot more than just a low-level virtual machine. But Yeah, the acronym still is the name for this whole compiler suite. What you can do there is you have access to the whole to the sources of the compiler and quite nice interfaces to the different steps that are involved in translating C, C++, and all the other languages that are running in this environment. Meanwhile, there's a few other projects that have risen to a similar to similar fame, so to say. But this was the one that was most open to students and teachers in the past. So that's why I started the slides with this one. Yeah, you will see on the following slides code from the LLVM intermediate representation. This is a kind of a layer between the source code and the actual machine code. It is meant to be quite independent of the architecture that it is actually translated on and for, and so it is a kind of a meta assembler. So that's why I chose the whole thing. I didn't want to do something specifically for kind of Intel, AMD, or any other concrete hardware, so that the whole ideas stay a little bit portable for you. So yeah, also it still has a few nice properties, like you are still able to see the types of things that you're handling, and yeah, you still get some kind of basic structural control elements, like there's no full pointer arithmetics involved, but instead there's certain special purpose instructions that kind of abstract on the doing pointer arithmetics, so that you can translocate the whole code to another architecture quite easily. So anyway, what are the important things that you need to know on the next slides? Well, there's the way how to specify structure definitions in the low-level virtual machine. Well, first of all, there will be identifiers, and each of these identifiers are introduced with the what's this modulo operator? Does anyone know the what this character is called? Percent sign or something? So the person sign escapes ordinary things and makes the next thing an identifier. Then comes the name of the identifier. Then you can do assignments with the assignment operator. And in case where you define a type for something, then you start with type, which is followed by curly brackets, which are the area that is comprised by this type. And within such a type, you can use, for example, basic data types like an integer of 32 bits length. You can have pointer types with a star. You can have function types, which is like this. This is a function that gets an integer as a parameter and returns back an integer. And you can also refer to other structures by just mentioning them there. This means that the struct B, for example, is included within the struct A. This is quite handy when you compose your data types from each other, which would be something that is heavily used in object orientation or in implementing object orientation. What there's also is you can generate arrays of things, like having 20 times 32-bit integers in there, and you can have 10 times arrays of 20 integers, like this one. So you can also compose them with each other. So that is how you have to read these data types. Then, what else can be done with LVM? There's, of course, there's assignments. There can be different right-hand sides of assignments. You can have allocation of objects. For example, here you allocate the memory for the data type struct A. Then there's ways of navigating within these objects. This navigation is split into two parts. You have the part where the actual selection of where you want to go within one of the data types is done. That is done with one of these get element pointer instructions. And then there's the actual instruction to dereference the address. Like here. Okay. So this get element pointer is multifold. So what you give it as parameters is a kind of list of parameters of arbitrary length. And it is meant to be interpreted in a certain way. The first argument is the initial pointer where you want to start your address selection. In this case, we give it a pointer to a struct A. What you do here is, first of all, you with the first component you can change the memory area where this pointer is pointing to. Remember that in C or C++, the difference between arrays and pointers is actually not there. So you could interpret in this A identifier also as being a an array of struct A type. So with the first parameter, you would tell the system that you want the first of potential array, so you would index it with zero. This kind of moves from pointer to the struct A into the actual struct. And with the next thing, you can select within the struct A, so you have to count. So let's stick in the struct A. We have the zero element here, the first element here, and the second element here. So with this, we would select the third, or if you prefer it zero indexed, then the second element of the struct. And the reference to there you store into the temporary variable one. So in the next instruction, you can dereference this with the load instruction and store the thing that you get from there in the temporary variable two. Yeah, and then what you can do next is then, for example, you can call your function pointer that you've retrieved from this struct. You can give it a parameter. You do it like this. You tell the system that you have a 32-bit integer of value 42, and yeah, you call the whole thing, and you get your return value as something that you can assign to another variable. So that is how you have to read this LVM intermediate representation. And there might be a few other instructions in the examples, but most of them should be fairly clear of what they do, like basic arithmetics or something. I'm sure you will cope with that. If you want to generate examples for this intermediate representation code, you can quite easily do so by, for example, installing your C-Lang or Clang compiler on your system and give it the right parameters, so it will emit, instead of machine code, emit LLVM code. In order for the LLVM code to reflect the basic principles of translation, you should probably turn off most of the this was not the one. This was the one. You should also turn off most of the optimizations so that only the basic translation principles are applied. And yeah, then you can get your LLVM code via this. The other thing that might be interesting for you is we will talk a lot about the memory layout in the following. So if you want the compiler to help you in how the memory layout actually looks like, you can use the first instruction with these parameters. This will make the LLVM compiler dump the layout of all the records and objects that are used within this code fragment. So yeah, you don't have to think about all the things yourself, but you can use the compiler for that. So these are the basic tools that should help you in doing all this. Let's have a look into how the compiler actually does implement inheritance in or basic objects in memory and in code. So let's start with a very basic example where we have only three classes involved, and there's a little bit of inheritance going on. So we have classes A, B, and C, and C inherits from B, B inherits from A. And yeah, the way that C++ manages the objects for this class is that there are record types that are defined for these classes. For A, for example, let's start with that because it is the base of all. For objects of class A, the type will be, well, the only thing that needs to be managed in kind of in terms of attributes for A is that there is an attribute of type integer in there. So that is what we will find within the record type to represent objects of class A. Next thing is we also introduce this class B that is extending class A, and it comes with another attribute also of type integer. So the C++ system will declare another record type for B. And this record type will have the attribute that is new for the objects of class B, which is another integer. But it also comprises everything that was inherited from A by just referring to the type of A here. So it is a kind of compositional way to lay out the the memory for the class representations. And yeah, when you see something like this, where you call a method on one of these objects, yeah, you see something going on that we have seen also on the last time that we met, meaning that this special variable here that is meant as the receiver of this message, or would be the object that this method call belongs to, is in the source language is treated specially with this special receiver style of how to notate this this method call, and in the target architecture in this LVM intermediate representation, this special treatment of the receiver is gone, and it mutates to the to another parameter. So the receiver here is treated like an ordinary parameter, like the 42 is also a parameter. So and the whole system, the whole C++ system, when trying to translate the whole thing, will come up with calling the G, as this is a static method. It was defined in B, and it provides this G with a pointer to the this object. A pointer to this is one that comes from casting the pointer of C to class B, and this is actually something that will end up with no transformation of the actual value of the pointer, since within class C, class B is at the very beginning. So there's absolutely no difference in the place where the whole thing starts. So you see, it is quite meaningful to create your object representations in the way that it is done here, because if you choose the sequence in which you compose the representations to a larger representation, if you do it in a way that the inherited data type comes at the very start of your representation, then you can translate the code for your methods in a way that you don't have to do any kind of pointer arithmetic to your receiver pointer. What do I mean with that? Let's have a look at how a method body is translated. So here we have a look at how the implementation for G is done. And the main thing that is of interest here is how is the addressing of the attribute done. So the within methods that is defined for a B object, you can access the attribute small b. And how can you do something like this? Well, you get the receiver pointer, or the this pointer, as your first parameter. And when you look at that, you can statically say which that's probably not the right thing. You can statically just count which of the entries in this struct is actually the one that points to the space that is meant to be used for B. So in order to do so, what you do in G is you take your list pointer, and first of all, choose to go from the pointer to the actual thing where you're pointing to with a zero here. Then you have a look at the first component in the zero indexed record. So you count 0, 1, and you arrive at the section that is meant to be used for B. This is the kind of reference that you still need to load into another variable, and with this variable then you can do your computations, which is in this case just adding the value to the parameter. Then you can do a return. So the main thing to take away from this is that the method implementation is meant to be modular, so it is meant to be reused for every time that one of these methods is actually called. And there's a kind of contract going on here, and this the contract is that you get a pointer to as your first parameter that actually points to a representation of the class that this G belongs to. So this must be a pointer to a class B representation. If you think back, what we have actually done here is, we have provided the whole thing with such a percent one, and this percent one was created from actually a C class representation, but it has gone through one of these bitcast things. But this bitcast is something that doesn't actually change the value of what is given to it. It just modifies the type, so it has no real effect on the actual value of the reference that it is given. So this is just for a type system, this bitcast. And but the whole system works because even though you are still pointing to the same place as before, and this is at the beginning of the C, we have organized our object layout in a way that the B is at the same, starts at the same position as the C. So this B is right at the start, so the whole system still works. This is kind of important because that is something that's going to change in a few slides. So, yeah. Okay. So.
Yes. In this type definition on the upper right.
Yes.
The methods are not there. Or
yes.
Okay, so there.
Why is that? The methods. Yeah. The thing is, what are these methods? When do these methods actually differ from each other? Do you need to store method pointers for each object or for each class?
No,
for the class. So the things that I'm painting here are actually meant to be representations of the objects. So you don't need to keep any references to the static methods, at least. So these method names here are kind of common for all the objects of this of these classes of the objects of class B. So these are kind of static and do not change. And in case you want to call them, you have a fixed address, which is a constant throughout the whole program. So this does not need to be stored somewhere in its object representation. It can be kept as a global constant. Okay. Of course, there's even more complex things going on that are more like the way that if that the whole system is organized in Java, and these are virtual methods or dispatched methods. These are a little bit different. Last time you've seen how the Java Virtual Machine, at least initially, works to resolve calls in presence of virtual methods. You've seen that there's a kind of linear search through the list of classes that are connected with each other through the super reference is going on. So this was meant to be the way how to resolve your method call to the most recent implementation of a certain method within C++. The idea is kind of the same. You would to have the most recent implementation of a certain method, but as C++ has undergone a lot of optimizations, one of the things that bothered people was that for each dispatched method call, you needed to look through this chain of superclasses to locate the most recent implementation, although this is something that could be done a little bit better. And the way how to do that would be to use virtual tables. These virtual tables are kind of pre-computed search runs through the chain of super classes. And yeah, they kind of cache the results of these pre-computed searches. So yeah, how are they, how do they look like? Well, at first, on the source level, if you want to have something like dispatched methods, you need to introduce a keyword when you specify your methods, and also you need to declare these methods in the at some place later on when you actually provide such a method, you do not need to mark them as being virtual anymore because they are associated to be assumed to be virtual automatically as soon as they match the signature that has been defined as virtual in the base class. Okay, so the inheritance structure is once again the same. We have class A. This is the base class for B. B is the base class for C. And this time, our methods F, J, and H are meant to be dispatched. So I marked them as being virtual in the base class. A side mark for all the people who try to type all the examples that I have in their laptops, in their C++ compilers. I have left out a few bits of C++ semantics in there, for example, the public and private and all these markers. But I think if you are a little bit familiar with C++, you might get where you have to place all these little bits. I've only kept the ones that are interesting for the aspect of inheritance here. Anyway, what is changed when I introduce virtual methods? For virtual methods, there is a new data structure, which is here. There is a data structure that keeps information about function pointers. You were mentioning where the function pointers are actually stored in the last example. So, in last example, there wasn't anything to store because it was statically clear what has to be used. Here, in this example, it's not the case anymore. So I have to keep a list of the actual addresses of methods that are meant to be called at runtime in a list, and this list is referenced from the object representation now, and this is done at the very first position, the very first position in an object representation. Now there's a pointer, and this pointer points to a table where all the methods have entries and can be looked up. So in the LLVM syntax, this is done by, let's start with class A. Class A is the one where all this dispatching starts. So class A needs to have a pointer to the virtual table. So the very first element that is inside of this record is actually a pointer to the virtual table. The type of this pointer may look a little bit weird to you because it's actually a pointer to a function. This has to do with, this is the common type of all the entries that are within this table, because what we have used is we have, for all of them, we have specified int as a return value, so that's why the whole system assumes that there's an integer return type. But anyway, the main thing is that there's a pointer that is stored there, and how it is cast afterwards, used afterwards, is anyway just determined via the bit casts that are occurring in the program. So you should not worry too much about that. The main thing is that there's a pointer, and this is the pointer to the virtual table. Then comes the attribute that belongs to the class, which is this A. And apart from that, everything is, mostly similar to it has been before in terms of, for example, for the class C, what is going on there is you have a reference to the data type for class B, and also a slot where you can store your information for the integer that is stored. But there's also something that might be a little bit surprising here, but in concrete translations of this LLVM or C-Lang compiler, you might see some kind of type confusion going on. For example, here this type for class B looks like it is organized as having 12 times integer of length 8 as its first component. Of course, that's not the idea of the record for type B, but if you count the length of this array 12 times integer of 8 of width 8 is actually same as size of a pointer, which is 64 plus size of the 32-bit integer. So this is just a kind of a placeholder for a class A thing, but it is treated as another type for some internal reason. So it has the right size, but is noted. Has a little bit of a weird notation. Okay, so what differs from the code that you've seen before is now that we have virtual methods. You don't have a statically known method anymore that you is meant to be called whenever you issue a call to G, because whatever the static type of your receiver might be, there might be a dynamically created object, which is a subclass of your receiver's static class, which might have a newer version of this G. And in order to cope with these situations, the actual address of the executable code that is that has to be executed for a call to G is not anymore statically compiled into some number, but instead is looked up in the virtual table. So in order to translate this dispatch call here, what you need to do is, well, at first you need to create a reference to your virtual table. That's done with a simple bitcast, so there's no manipulation of pointers has to be going on because, well, it is stored as the first element of your record anyway. And then you can load the whole thing to get your virtual table point that you referenced. So now with this %1, or first local, you are actually handling your virtual table. So in order to select the entry for G, you have to get the first element. Remember, zero, first. So what is now handled statically is just the index. No, the index in the virtual table instead of the actual address of your G. So it's the system always takes the first entry in the virtual table as the one that is associated with the call to here. And yeah, this one is then loaded and used as a dynamic call here. And apart from that, it gets its receiver value and its parameter. So that is what changes when you go from your from ordinary methods to virtual methods in C++. Okay. So these are just the very basics. The question now is, with this in mind, how can we do with several parent objects? Well, in this case, my classes would be related in a way like this. I have C as my child object, and A and B are both meant to be parents for the whole thing. So, yeah, what would you do for layering that? Well, same thing as before. You would try to compose the representation for C, and yeah, you would use references to representations for A and B inside the method C. So that's what's done here. So here for the representation of C, I have references to A and B. And A and B only need to carry fields for the attributes. Okay, and the main thing now is that if you look at a call to a method G, for example, that has been inherited by C from B, so you have the G that comes from B. The principle that we had for modulars for modular programming was that I have already have a translation of the method G that has been generated when I had to generate the code for the class B, and I want to reuse it. Because it's not feasible to generate all the different versions of methods for all the classes that that can be combined from the ones that from base classes here. So the idea would be to reuse the implementation of G, and this at first seems to be quite nice, but then we remember well. One of the contracts that we were given at first was that in order for G to execute properly, what we need to provide it with is a reference to the beginning of the representation of a B object. Now, although we are still able to call G, we have a representation of a C object in our receiver reference. So the problem is, what we would need to have is the representation for B, but what we really have is a representation of C. So I have, in order for G to work, I have to do a little bit of manipulations, and that's what's going on in the code over here. So what I need to do is I need to manipulate the thing that I will use as my receiver reference, and I need to compute it somehow out of what I get as the C's representation. So I have to manipulate the local one somehow, and that's what I'm doing here with the get element pointer. And what I'm doing here is I select within my C representation the fourth element. Well, in this case, the whole thing is a little bit obfuscated, as I this offset 4 seems to be weird at the first glance, but you have to keep in mind that this get element pointer here is performed or interpreted as being a pointer to integers of size 8. So what is done is at first the pointer to the class is casted to pointer of integers of size 8, and then I take 4 of these integers, or the fourth of these integers, which is actually the exactly the size that one of these class A representations has. So this one is exactly 4 times the size of an integer of size 8. So that is what this difference in the offsets from my actual receiver and the B subpart of it actually has. So that is something that has to be done before I do my call, because afterwards I'm just able to reuse my old G definition and be satisfied with that. Okay. What is then the case? Actually, that is something that I have already done before. I should have switched the slides around a little bit, I think, because this is once again this is the one of the steps that we have seen on the slides before, which is actually one of these casts, and this is the same instruction. So I think I've have to switch the slides, so that's not anything anymore. Okay, so back to our original topic. With multiple inheritance, I also import a few problems within my implementation. And the problem is that, imagine a situation where I have two base classes, A and B, and both of them provide functions of the same signature. In this case, this void f with a parameter int. And I'm, of course, allowed to inherit from both. So A and B are now base classes for C. But anyway, there's a problem now, because whenever I try to call such a method f, now it's not so clear anymore which of the ones that were provided by my basis is the one that I wanted to call. So, bummer. What should I do now? The I have several solutions. The one that C++ offers is the one that does everything manually. You have to explicitly qualify what should be done in the situation. So you have to do an explicit declaration of what you want to what to want to call here. The other solution would be some kind of automatic way to come up with the thing that the user probably wanted to call here. So how could you achieve something like that? Well, the idea would be that the compiler would need to introduce some kind of precedence between the different candidates of your parents. And yeah, that's something that I want to show you in the next slides. So that is called linearization, because when you do this multiple inheritance, you have at first you kind of declare in several steps certain relations between classes that are kind of imposing a local ordering. And what linearization does, it takes these local ordering definitions and tries to come up with a linearized chain of precedences between your classes. So what are the sources for such a linearization? Of course, there's the inheritance relation. That's the first thing. That is the one that you declare by extending from a base class somehow. And in a more mathematical way, you a more short, abbreviated way, you would declare them in a way like this. C is derived from A and B. This would mean for my linearization that C is somewhere before A, and C has to come also somewhere before B. So that is done by your inheritance relation. The other source for precedences between classes might originate from the actual sequence in which you specify your parents. So that is something that is called the multiplicity relation. So if you specify your C being an extension of A, an extension of B, then multiplicity would mean that this would imply that A also has to come in front of B. Okay, so in general, what you should keep in mind for linearization is that linearization is something that is meant to be interpreted in the context of whole classes. So there's no difference made between attributes or methods, or even one method or the other. All of them are kind of preferred to all of them of another class, or the other way around, depending on the result that the linearization comes up with. So a linearization is always defining a relation on whole classes and all its members, of course. And what also comes with that is that linearization is something that is a kind of best effort approach, because there's with local definitions you can do a lot of havoc and define a lot of things that make sense in an isolated way. But if you see them in a global context, you might come up with quite confusing examples, or even examples that cannot be linearized in any meaningful way. So yeah, there are a lot of approaches to doing things like linearization, some of them being more accepted than others. But yeah, let's see what those are about. So in we're going to have a look at a few of the alternatives that are there for linearization. And all of them actually have certain examples of programming languages where they have been applied to. So, yeah. Method resolution order via depth-first search. Depth-first search is one of the things that has drawn a lot of attention to by a lot of languages in order to come up with a method resolution order. So, yeah, you see at the bottom of my examples always the local definitions of inheritance. So A is a child class of B and C, and to show in the inheritance graph also the multiplicity, I have introduced this dotted lines here that should symbolize that coming from A, you want to prefer B, considering B and C. So yeah, that is a representation for ABC here, and the graph also comprises the inheritance relation that B specializes W, and also C specializes W. Okay, so with a leftmost pre-order depth-first search, that was one of the first ideas for resolving method calls. What would be the outcome? What would be my linearization? Is there anyone who does not know what leftmost pre-order depth-first search is? Well, depth-first is... Okay. So depth first search is well, pretty clear. You have to agree on the on the sequence in which you you iterate over the children of a node. So that's what I have specified here with this leftmost. So I always go to the left branch whenever I have a choice, and I yield the nodes that I pass in pre-order. So before descending down to the children, I yield the node that I'm currently at. So with the leftmost pre-order depth-first search, well, I start from A, for example, and yeah, what will I do? Yeah, what's the outcome of the linearization? Mm-hmm. So you have A and B.
And then you go depth first, so you go to W.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go back and try C.
Mm-hmm. So this is a good linearization. So the something that would bother you is the sequence here. So actually, it would prefer the W to the C, although W is the parent of C in our specification here. Actually, yeah, that violates the principle one for inheritance. But surprisingly, something like leftmost pre-order depth-first search was a linearization concept that was actually used in Python, for example, for classical Python objects up to the version 2.1, as it seems. Yeah, so there has been refinements to this, which led to leftmost pre-order depth-first search with duplicate elimination. Any idea what that would mean?
Mm-hmm. Perhaps after from C we go to W, we again write W, but the needs is previous W.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So the idea is once again A, B, W, C, and W. So I mention them again, and once that I yield them again, I cancel any duplicates of the whole thing. So I remove this W. So that is actually what is the what was the idea for the next iteration of the Python linearization in version 2.2. But actually, it turns out that this might also yield quite confusing outputs. So, for example, the object graph that you see here, specified with these things. Yeah, what would be the outcome of that? We can do it together. So. Start with A. Then I need to go leftmost, so B. I once again need to go leftmost. I get V, and I get W. And I go back to C. This time I go to. Yeah, that is something that is not so easily visualized in something like this, because now the leftmost branch would actually mean to take the W. So don't be confused when I now take the one that seems to be to the right. So actually this one is chosen, and then W afterwards. The duplicates are removed. And this is the linearization that comes from that. So I get A, B, C, W, V. This actually is a valid linearization. You could do that. But you also see that this is only a best effort thing. The multiplicity was something that could not be really fulfilled. So multiplicity was violated here. And the thing that bothered most people was, although the linearization at first gave B the priority or the preference to C. Actually, the multiplicity that was defined by B, which was obviously preferred to C, was overwritten by the multiplicity that was implied by the other definition. So that was something that bothered a lot of people and also made some strange decision. Anyway, this thing made it as the method resolution order for Python 2.2. Okay, good. So that's so far. Now there's another approach now from another language. This is Lisp now. This is method resolution via reverse post order, rightmost depth first search. that means that you have to yield your nodes in reverse order. So the first one that you yield will be the last one of your linearization. And also you have to run through your graph in post order. Or yield in post order, which means that you yield after you have yielded all your children's nodes. So what does that accomplish? Just in principle, because that's a large graph. You start with an A, but as it is post order, you do not yield right now, but you go down rightmost, so you choose the C. From that, you go rightmost to the H, and then to the W. This is the last one in the chain, so you output W. then you retract, go back to H. So H is the next one that you give give out. Then C is still not completely done, so I have to go down to E. E is not done, so I have to go to G. G is now the one that I have to give out, and I have to go back to E, and so forth. So that is the way how the whole thing works. And this yields as an inheritance relation something like this. So this is something like topological sorting that you compute here. That's already quite nice because that is fulfilling the inheritance relation. However, you can still construct examples where you violate your other measure, and that is the multiplicity. For example, in the graph over here. No, not like this. In the graph over here, you are the thing that starts problems is, well, I won't go into the details now, but I will show you the cause of what can be the problem. Here you have your E, which points to F. So F will be the last one in your linearization. Then a few steps later, you will get to the D, which will give you G, but G will now end up in my linearization further to the left. And at the very last, I will arrive at B, and B now specifies that F has to come before G. So that is what will happen. For the or what happened in the reverse post order rightmost DFS, so the F and the G were in this sequence, although the multiplicity of B said that F and G have to be in the order F G. Okay, so this reverse post-order rightmost definition is still not what we were probably looking for, but actually there is a linearization that fulfills multiplicity and the inheritance rules. And the way that Lisp does is that it refines the linearizations or refines with the help of linearizations that violate certain multiplicities by extending this inheritance graph with new edges. So there's the edge that was violated, which is this multiplicity between F and G, is then added as a new edge in this graph, and the whole thing is rerun. And if you do that, it turns out you get a refined graph that does not violate the multiplicity anymore. So that is what the CLIS system uses as its linearization, which is pretty complicated already, but doing a quite nice job for that. Yes?
About the refinement, does it also add the F between the D and E?
No, because the D and the E have already been in the right sequence from the start. So D and E are already... So it only adds the ones that were conflicting with the linearization that was found. However, there's still possibilities that this algorithm will fail. In this case, the whole system will bail out and say it cannot linearize the types that you've given them. So it's there is still the failed path in the whole thing. Okay, that's already pretty advanced stuff, but... actually, it turns out that one of the things that practical systems wanted to have was a notion of monotonicity. That means that when you do your linearization computations, you want the system to behave consistently throughout extensions. that you add later on. So when you take a look at linearizations for only a part of your system, for example, if you look at a linearization for B, then you might end up with a certain linearization. And if you look at the linearization for C, locally, this might also end up with another linearization, which would be, both of them would be completely fine regarded in isolation. But extending the system with a class A that inherits from B and C, and computing a linearization then that that enables conclusions of classes being or that 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 implies that certain classes are more special than others, which is contradictory to the linearizations that you've computed before, then monotonicity is not given anymore, which means you have a more formal definition of this down here. So if C1 is preferred to C2 in C's linearization, then this preference should also be implied for the linearization of every ones of C's children. So this makes a kind of incremental compiling more intuitively, because without this property, you might switch around the order in which methods are dispatched to in child classes, and you cannot reflect this behavior in your parent classes, and that's was confusing a lot of people. So the monotonicity of such a linearization system was originally not respected. So, for example, the refined reverse post order, rightmost, and so on, system of linearization, for example, was not guaranteeing this property. So this was one that switched around the precedences in linearizations when you moved on to larger systems. So, for example, in the linearizations that you've seen so far, is for the example over there, is that for the linearization of A, for example, that was the one that was giving A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and was implying that F is preferred to G for resolution of methods. But having a look at C in an isolated way without the A around, in this case, the linearization would yield DGEF, which is logical, because for the refined reverse post order, rightmost, depth first search, we did a refinement of the whole graph after we have ascended up and descended on the other side, which was not visible when I was looking at the C part exclusively. So that was some kind of idea that was lost for my exclusive view on C's linearization. So that is something that is not desired for in modern languages, linearization. So what they did was they introduced another algorithm for that, which is called the C3 linearization, which is the quite a lot of recent implementations of linearization, of languages that use linearization. They apply C3 linearization now, and for C3 linearization, there's the linearization is something that is modular, which is composing linearizations for their children's out of their children's linearizations. So, in order to compute the linearization for a class C that is extending B1 to Bn, what is done is that C is put in the front of the linearization list, and the rest is composed of the linearizations of the children together with the multiplicity. And the way how they are composed is defined by this least upper bound operator, and this treats the linearizations as lists. What it does is it looks at all the these linearization lists and looks primarily at the heads of these lists, at the first elements of these lists, and it runs through all the lists from the left to the right, and takes the heads of these lists and looks whether these heads are occurring in the tail of any of the other lists. And in case that they do not occur in the tail of any of the other lists, this head is then taken and taken as the one that has to move to the front. And then it is removed from all the other lists as well as the one that it was taken from. In case that there could not be identified any head element of these lists that was exclusively that did not occur in the tails of the remaining linearizations, then the whole algorithm would detect a violation of of monotonicity, and then just say fail. I cannot find a linearization that will not move around or switch any any linearization properties. So, in the example, what would how would C3 work? Well, once again, the graph that we had before for for definitions where we have we don't have any base classes, it's just the classes themselves. Then there are the simple ones, EF and DG. For those, there's not so much to do. You can just put in the class itself and its base class. But now it gets more interesting for. F and G, which are base classes for B, both of them, it's not, both of them don't have any children, but at least there are several of them, so I need to take care which of them I put in front. But yeah, that is, when I execute my algorithm, I know that the B is the one that goes in front of the linearization list, and I take the linearizations of F, of G, and the multiplicity, and then apply my least upper bound operator, which means I run through the lists from the beginning, take, so I have to inline the lists, these are F, G, and F, J. So at first I take the F, no, not like this, I take F, and compare the tails of all the other lists with this F. So there's no tail, so I have to don't have to compare anything. Here's G. G is different from F, so I can take F as my next element, and then the only one that is remaining is G, so I come up with BFG. Not so difficult. Now, CDE, which is just applying the definition, which is computed like this. I can inline my intermediate results like this. Now I have to rerun my linearization algorithm and the least upper bound. So I have to start with the first head, which is D. D is not occurring in any of these, so I can take D as the next element in my linearization. I have to take G. G is also not occurring here, and there is no no tail for this list anymore, so I can take G as my next, and then there is also only E and F remaining, and these are I can take them. So the last one, which is the interesting one because it will lead us to a conflict, is working well, same as before. I have to take the linearizations for B and C, which are these two, together with the multiplicity B and C. And then I run my head search. First I look at B. B is not occurring anywhere else, so I can move it up front. In fact, there's a lot of these classes that do not occur in the tails, up to the point where I can where I want to take F as the head of my first list. Then I see, oh, F is occurring here, so I cannot take F as next possibility for linearization. So I have to have a look at the next list. There, G is the head element. I have to check for all the other linearization lists whether G is occurring, but G is occurring here. So now I am in a situation where I cannot choose any head of any lists in there, which means, well, that is a situation where I cannot find a consistent constructed linearization via C3. So in this case, I have to fail. So the information that I've given the system here is not sufficient for a C3 linearization. Okay, so I'm sure you will have the possibility in the tutorials to compute a little bit in these linearizations. However, C3 is the one that is that's chosen by most modern systems like OpenDylan, Python, Perl. Well, that is the one that is used in all of them, and it gives you monotonicity at the cost of linearization failing in a few cases. So that's summing up linearization for you. You have benefits from linearization because you don't need to have duplexer code manually. You have a unique super reference that is something that is not given to you in a system where you have no preference on your parents. You don't have to explicitly name with qualifiers the versions that you want to have. And there's also pros for the qualification approach. It is more fine-grained. You can differentiate on method level which of the ancestors versions you want to actually dispatch to. And linearization choices might be awkward in some cases or fail in a few cases. Well, however, languages in there's a lot of languages that have automatic linearization, and something like linearization is also a prerequisite for other means of software modularization, for example, mix-ins that we will talk about in a few lectures. Okay, so that's all for today. We will continue next time with other aspects of multiple inheritance. I hope you had fun today, and I wish you a nice week. See us all together next week. Goodbye.